they might as well go to a banquet someplace, and all seven of them stand up and say, next time we get a case like this, we're going to make this decision. It's improper for them to announce their decision in classes of cases that aren't before the court. If a judge got out and made that statement on the stump when he was running for election, the Bar Association would be all over him for being unethical. He has no business announcing to the public what kinds of decisions he's going to make in what classes of cases in the future. I mean, that's pandering for votes based on how you're going to decide your cases. And yet the court does it, and has done it many times in the books, where they do this so-called true prospectivity. It's an absolute abomination. It is an absolute perversion of the judicial process. Okay, and it was in that context that I said, George Edwards wrote such an opinion, a true prospective opinion, which he said, he began the opinion, from this day forward, were his words, okay? It was a pronunciation, it was an edict, it wasn't a damn decision, it was an edict that attempted to change the law prospectively, okay? Now, after the Edwards edict, and I whether that was the Myers case or what, but on this subject, along came another case. Some other plaintiff, through ingenuity or perseverance or whatever, worked his way up to the Supreme Court, and his injury had occurred prior to the day that Brother Edwards had announced was the effective date of this new rule. And what did the court do? They decided the case in accordance with the new rule. So despite George Edwards' announcement that as of today the rule is going to be different for all future cases, in due course of time, when a case came up that had begun prior to that day, the court decided in favor of the plaintiff, in effect ignoring Edwards's prospectivity pronouncement. Now, I cited that to show that when Edwards announced that the rule was being changed today, from this day forward, that it was sheer nonsense or poppycock. And that was the basis, and I called it that in my opinion. I said this is sheer poppycock. The court cannot announce future decisions. They can't bind future courts. You know, and so it's sheer poppycock. And Hiram Bond, who was for many years the reporter of the Michigan Supreme Court decisions, the person responsible for the editorial cleanup work and the management of the printing and publishing of the opinions, was a wonderful, kindly old and scholarly old gentleman with the court for many, many years before I came. And Hiram was a stickler on grammar, pronunciation, and so forth. After you wrote your opinion and circulated to the other justices your draft, a copy would go to Hiram, and he would read it, and you'd get a memorandum from Hiram about corrections that he was suggesting you make. Always very polite, always very deferential, but always very firm that it was improper for you to do this or whatever. But he recommended highly that you don't use this phrase or that, whatever. And in this case, Hiram's memorandum said that challenged the use of the word poppycock, and I think as a matter of fact he phoned me. I don't think it was in a memorandum. He phoned me because I remember him telling me that that the way in which words were used in Supreme Court opinions was one of the sources that lexicographers go to get the information for dictionaries and are able to say this word has found acceptance in the language and so on and so forth. If it's being used in Supreme Court opinions, that's a very good evidence that it's accepted in the language. So he said, you don't want to use this word because the word poppycock means soft dung. And he sort of suggested it was a crass and perhaps a inappropriate word for a Supreme Court opinion. And I said, Hiram, that's exactly what I meant to say, and I left it in. So if poppycock or soft dung becomes in the next edition of Webster's Dictionary as a common usage to indicate, to mean nonsense or foolishness, maybe I had some contribution to that cause. Anyway, where were we? Does that cover that whole thing, huh?
Well, but remember, you had some other observations to make about this kind of. I remember City Detroit versus Jackson.
Okay.
JAXON. Is that?
I don't know how we segued from the poppycock story into Jackson. Possibly it had to do with if there was a stream of consciousness in our discussions on the tape previously. It may have been that we were talking about opinions and words that you use in opinions, and that might have brought me to talk about City of Detroit versus Jackson, because City of Detroit versus Jackson is an opinion which I can even give you citation for, because I happen to have pulled it down off the shelf. It appears in volume 379 of the Michigan Reports and begins at page 405. And I'm glad I got it down, because my recollection of the case was not accurate. And having refreshed my recollection, I can give a better statement of what the case was. But I have referred to Detroit versus Jackson on a number of occasions because it was my one excursion during my service on the Supreme Court into the area of judicial humor, and my one attempt to be funny, which I'll tell you how what the result was.
This was a case about the woman that stepped off the streetcar.
It's the lady that stepped off the bus.
The bus.
The bus driver stopped. Instead of stopping where she could step onto the curb, she stepped down into the street. So instead of having perhaps 10 or 12 inches to step off of the last step of the bus to the ground, she had to go about 16 or 18 inches down to the street level. And I tell the story of her fall very matter-of-factly, in my opinion, until I reached the bottom of page 409, and I said she apparently expected to step onto the curb, but alas, there was no curb underfoot, and the plaintiff went a-tumbling. Then I say, Mrs. Jackson fell victim to Fettridge's law. And there's a footnote there, and then I don't know if you want me to read this footnote onto the tape, but the footnote refers to Claude Fettridge, an employee of NBC, who conceived the idea of broadcasting the whir and flutter of the eager wings of the swallows departing the Mission San Juan Capistrano in Southern California on October 23rd, which is St. John's Day. And that was traditionally supposed to be the case, except that when they got all set up with their equipment to record it and broadcast it, they discovered that the birds had left the day before. So Fettridge's law came to be known in the circle of humorists, where they have these so-called laws of probability, to be stated as follows, the principle of Fettridge's law, that important things which are supposed to happen do not happen, especially when people are looking. All of which can be found in a book by H. Allen Smith called A Short History of Fingers. And well, I won't belabor it. Elsewhere in that opinion, I made reference to Gumperson's law, which is generally stated that the contradictory of a welcome probability will assert itself whenever such an eventuality is likely to be most frustrating. Anyway, I played around with these two humorous rules of probability, and fortunately or unfortunately, I managed to get a majority of the court to agree with the result of my decision, at least, though not the words of my opinion, except that I got a lesson taught me by Justice O'Hara, who dissented in these words. He said, "I am uninstructed in Fettridge's law and Gumperson's law. Insofar as negligence law is concerned, I accept the statement of the Court of Appeals," and he goes on from there. So the embarrassment of having been attempted to be humorous, stuck with me for a long time, and I've occasionally used that to admonish young judges not to try to be funny in their opinions. That was that reference to H. Allen Smith.